Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Donaldson, Donaldson Files here on the Bastion News Radio Network. Dr. Larry will be joining us shortly. So we are going to have a pretty good conversation. We're going to be talking about the Virginia election, in particular a couple of comments made over the weekend with Barack Obama and Tom Sowell, you know, who have two opposite points of view of what the election in Virginia means and what basically 2022 and 24 will mean as well. So we're going to discuss that. We're going to also discuss kind of a statement that I was struck with. And and we're going to go into it. It's an interview done by the head of the European Research Council, development geneticist, Maria Lepkin. There's a couple of interesting quotes, and I wanted to kind of get Dr. Larry's opinion on those as soon as he comes on the air. And so we're going to, like I say, talk about those things, and a lot of different other things that are coming down the pike as well. We'll talk about education actually becoming a winning issue for Republicans, something that we have, you know, not seen in a long, long time. And so we're going to really get into some, you know, so those are the conversations we're going to be having later on this show. But I'm going to begin the show very quickly until Dr. Larry gets on. Is Major League Baseball. It's kind of in an interesting quandary here. Because the All-Star Game, the Commissioner of Baseball decided to move the state and to move the All-Star Game from Atlanta to eventually Denver, Colorado. Because of protests over the Virginia law, over the Georgia voting law, which he probably did bother reading. But now you got this interesting situation where the World Series, three of the seven games are going to be held in Atlanta, Georgia. And what happens when the Braves win the World Series? What if they win the World Series? Can you imagine what will happen then? I mean, can you imagine what the Commissioner of Baseball is going to be having to deal with? Maybe eating a little crow? And not only that, on top of all of that, you know, during the playoffs, you know, the infamous, or I should say famous shop or shop on, where literally the entire fans, do the chopping sign, representing and so that, and of course, you're going to have all of that as well. So it's going to be a very entertaining. Normally, I would say I try to keep my politics out of my sports, because sports is the one area where I usually go to escape from politics. But this is one of those series that you just get the feeling politics is going to be there in the back of everybody's mind because of the Georgia voting law, because of the politically incorrect shop, because of the names, the Braves. So you got the politically incorrect Braves on top of all of that. So I find myself in this peculiar. I'll be fascinated to see how the media covers this World Series. They have part of the Houston Astros, who basically biggest claim to fame is that that they were accused of cheating and stealing signals in 2017 when they won their World Series. And so, and of course, Houston's in Texas, which is, of course, one of those red states that has, one of those red states. So you got that. So, I mean, basically, if you were a liberal or a person on the left, you got to be asking yourself, who can I actually root for? Because because you got the Texan team, and then you got the Atlanta Braves with their politically incorrect Braves, with their politically incorrect chop, and having to be a reminder to Braves fans being reminded of the fact that this All-Star game was pretty much taken from them. And you got to remember, Atlanta has got a high living there, a majority blacks, if I'm not mistaken, and certainly a lot of black businesses that would have benefited from the All-Star game, in which you went and took it to a city that was predominantly white. I mean, all in the name of social justice and racial equality and voting rights, whatever words you want to use. So it's going to be a series that I'm going to be keenly interested in. Not so much about what the game of the field, but I'm going to be fascinated by how the media covers this. And I'm going to welcome on the line the famous of the Resistance Hour, along with myself, Dr. Larry Peteroff. Hello, Dr. Larry. How you doing?
Well, I think I'm doing better when I hear that introduction.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you're a baseball fan, whether or not you even have an interest in the World Series, but I think it's going to be one of those World Series. I'm going to be fascinated to see how the media covers this, because you have on one hand Atlanta that was basically, I had the All-Star game taken from them because Major League Baseball and all of the lefties did not like the Georgia voting law. Then you got the team from Texas. So what can a liberal do in such a situation? Who can they root for? And so I don't know if you have any interest at all in this game.
Well, I must admit, I'm not very familiar with the ins and outs of all this. I do remember the All-Star the controversy, but I must admit I don't even know who's playing. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well,
I
want to
talk football. Yeah. I know a lot about that, but I don't know much about baseball.
Well, the Atlanta Braves are the National League champs. The Houston Astros are the American League champs. And I thought to myself, I mean, this is one of those series where, okay, you got a team from Texas, which is, which nobody in the particular, the political left, likes at the moment, along with Florida. And then you got the Atlanta Braves, where you got the politically incorrect Braves name, and they do the chop, where they all go, da, 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 they do the chop, where they take their arms and they move it forward while chanting in a very politically incorrect way. So and then on top of that, like you stated, they lost the World Series, they lost the All-Star game because supposedly they didn't, the Major League Baseball was doing this for voting rights when, in fact, as my brother said, the Major League Commissioner ought to read publicly the voting bill before he's allowed into the stadium. They can understand exactly what it is. He left. So it's going to be fast. It's one of those things where, normally, like I said, this one, if you would have asked me about a week ago, I would have cared less. Be either one of these two teams. Because it's like, I just want to see a good series, but I kind of decided, I would love to watch the Braves win just so the Major League Commissioner would have to be transferring the trophy to the Atlanta Braves in their locker room. It would be even greater if they do it at home in Game 5. But that is that. What I'm going to do, we're going to take a quick break. And then what I'm going to do here, as I say, we're going to do this. I'm going to read a couple of statements from Barack Obama, Tom Sowell, on the Virginia election, what it means. Get your thoughts on what they said and go from there. We're going to talk about, there's a quote that struck me about science and politics by the head of the EU, the European Union's Research Council, which I thought was interesting. And I want to get your opinions on that. And we'll go from there. So it's Tom Donaldson, Donaldson Files here at the Bastion News Radio Network.
Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m. I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m. I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m. I shower. Every day I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m. I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m. I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Since Buffalo Wild Wings is always open late, here are a few things you'll enjoy. Buzzer beaters, wings in 21 signature sauces and seasonings, and great deals on food and beer. Grab select domestic draft beers starting at $4. $4 shareables like street tacos, fried pickles, chili queso dip, mozzarella sticks, and roasted garlic mushrooms, and deals on select liquor and house cocktails. Phew, that's a mouthful. Catch all of the late night action. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports. Offers and participation vary. Please drink responsibly. Void where prohibited.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Donaldson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, you can listen to this show every day 11 a.m. and 4 p.m. on the BachelorNews.Airtime.Pro, BachelorNews.Airtime.Pro, and don't forget, we will be followed by You and the Law with Chief Keith Humphrey, Chief Virgil Green, with honest discussion about law enforcement and the relationship of black and brown communities. Listen every And so you can listen to that show as well every day. And it will be following the show on this particular network tonight. So stay tuned, stay informed here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. All right. Okay, and here's what I'm going to read here, folks. This is coming from Barack Obama and Tom Sowell. For those who, you know, most of you know who Barack Obama is, but you may not know who Tom Sowell. Tom Sowell is one of the leading economists and thinker probably in this past half century. He's written numerous books. He's an economist by trade. But he's also a conservative, and let's say a black conservative. And so so basically we're going to see two very interesting perspectives here on this, and then I'm going to get Larry's opinion. But I'll begin with Barack Obama. These are serious times, and we need serious people. We have too much to get done to be going backwards. We need to recover from a global pandemic that has killed more than 700,000 Americans, put millions in harm's way. We don't have time to waste on phony culture wars or fake outrage that right-wing media peddling just to juice up the ratings. You know we can go down this path, but this is the path to ruin. The good news is another path we can pull together where we can solve big problems together. We can rebuild our society in a way to give more and more people a better life. The choice we face, the choice that I believe would define not just the next few years, but the next few decades, and it determine for our kids and our grandkids. You can jump in front of a freight train, wrestle a bear for your kids, but right now we need to determine what kind of democracy they're going to inherit, what kind of planet they're going to inherit, what kind of economy they're going to inherit, and what are we leaving for them. That's our choice. Now, Tom Sowell wrote this. One of the reasons of many Virginia parents are outraged by the woke propaganda that their children are subject to in public school. And the governor has sided with the education bureaucrats and the teachers union. Very few politicians in the state dare to go against teachers unions. They have millions of votes, millions of dollars in campaign contributions. school propaganda teaches black kids to hit white kids. That is the danger to all Americans of every race. Anyone familiar with the history of group identity politics in other countries know how often ended up producing sickening atrocities that have torn societies apart. If you have a strong stomach, read about the 1915 atrocities against the Armenians, cleansing in the Balkans, or the reciprocal atrocity between the Sinhalese and Tamils in the Civil War in Sri Lanka. And don't kid yourself that this cannot happen in America. The relationship between the major groups in Sri Lanka was once held as a model of intergroup. They got along better than blacks and whites ever got along in the U.S. But then a demagogue polarized the country with group identity politics to get himself elected prime minister. But once he got elected, he was ready to moderate the position. But you cannot turn group hatred off and on like a light bulb. He was assassinated, and the hatred continued. There is a point of no return in America as well. We may be nearing it, perhaps past it. Low-income minority students cannot afford the luxuries of having their homes and their time wasted on ideology and propaganda in schools when they're not even getting a decent education in mathematics or the English language. I think you can make the case this is – so those are the two statements. So I will start with you, Dr. Larry. How do you view Barack Obama's? How did you view Tom Sowell? What do you think?
Well, Obama has always been pitching this theory, this goal of unity. You remember in his acceptance speech way back, he said there are no blue states or red states. They're United States. And he really talked about that theme on very frequently, even after his actions have never, unfortunately, been in tune with his goals or his rhetoric. And I think this is the same, another example of the same thing. He's accusing the Republicans of all the things that the Democrats are doing, you know, and that's been their favorite trick now for the last 10 years or so. So the fundamental rule, it seems to me, is the biblical rule: by their acts you shall know them. And it's not what you say, it's what you do. And what you do, what they've been doing, is extremely divisive. They are tearing down the very fabric of the United States culture. He's talking about we don't have time for talking about phony cultures. Well, yeah, you don't talk about it. You just go and destroy it. The man may believe a lot of this stuff too. I'm not saying that he's lying or being necessarily consciously duplicitous, but there's no consistency between what he says and what he's been doing for his whole political life that I can see. I think Sewell's got a much more down to earth and realistic kind of approach when he says, if our schools are teaching the black children to hate the white children, that this is very bad for the United States, and we can't really survive it. And that's true. I mean, we are the whole idea of the United States is that we put aside our tribal differences to the extent that we all agree that we will live under the same laws and under the same approach to justice. We said that the goal of the entire Commonwealth is the have the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the pursuit of happiness depends upon the law, and the law has to be, it has to be blind in terms of any tribal differences, whether of nationality or of skin color or of anything else. So, what Obama is talking about right now, we all agree with. What he's doing is exactly the opposite. And what the Bidens are doing is it's completely opposite of what they're professing in their rhetoric.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean, here's the thing. Like I say, phony cultural war. First of all, I don't think there are phony cultural wars here. I mean, what we're looking at is there's nothing phony about it, because basically what's happening in the classrooms are indeed a significant, it comes down to what does it mean to be an American? And we got a very big, wide gap, between those who are doing the educating and those who are being educated on what they want children to be taught and what it means to be American. And I also find it fascinating at the same time, you literally have, like in Lyon County, where you had a rape of a teenage girl in a bathroom, much of it due to quote-unquote transgender policy, where a boy put on a skirt, went in, and raped a girl, a teenage girl. And this
was covered up. And the principal wouldn't admit it. The principal said, well, it never got reported, so I guess it didn't happen.
Unfortunately, it did.
Talk about complicity, huh?
And the thing that comes into play is this. When the father goes to the school board to complain at a meeting, he's the one that gets arrested. I mean, he obviously showed some emotion to that meeting, but he was the one that gets arrested. And I just find myself fascinated with this whole thing. And again, I mean, it's not like, when Ukraine. And I don't know if you have a chance. Normally, I don't see the view.
It's not even common sense to say that that your sex is determined by what you think. I mean that it's so clear physically that it just it's ludicrous if you think it through, and yet you got all these people that are trying to pretend that your sexual identity depends upon what you think of it, what you think it is, not what you really are. That's crazy.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, it's kind of like one of those things where back to the other aspect of the education debate itself, what we call critical race theory. I thought it was very interesting, Condoleezza Rice, the former Secretary of State, was on The View, and she basically, people should get a YouTube on that, because she basically said, I don't want black children to be taught hatred for white children, and I don't want white children to be taught, feel guilty, but something different. I mean, she basically said, in fact, we got to get away from this hatred being taught, because that's exactly what we're doing. And I thought it was, it's one of those really interesting exchanges between her and Whoopi Goldberg, because usually Whoopi goes off, Whoopi and Joy Boy, they tend to go off on a tangent on these cases. But for once, Goldberg actually showed some respect. And there's a couple of statements that she made that, I don't think you and I would disagree with, David. We want, history to be taught, and not have all of the warts as well as the benefits of our society. We have never, I don't see anybody ever say we don't want that. But we also don't want an incorrect version of history taught. We certainly don't want to have a situation where we're talking about the balkanization and the separation by races of our society. And I want to kind of follow up on a point that Tom Soule makes, because it's a vitally important point. This is Tom Donaldson here on the Donaldson Files on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
A boy born in Joplin, Missouri, was fascinated by anything with wheels and a motor. The odds of him going on to fascinate millions with his talent? 1 in 260,000. The odds of this born racer having 157 career top 10 finishes in NASCAR? 1 in 125 billion. But every driver seeks the pinnacle of their achievements. The odds of him winning both the Daytona 500 and the Brickyard 400 in the same year? 1 in 195 million. The odds of a child being diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm NASCAR driver Jamie McMurray, and my niece has autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Napa know-how.
Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to Donaldson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network. You can listen to this show every day between 4 a.m. You can see 4 a.m. to noon, and you can also listen to the show 4 to 5 p.m. every day on the BachelorNews.airtime.pro Eastern Standard Time, or you can come to Central Time Zone. Central Time Zone, 10 and 3 a.m. 10 and 3 p.m. I got to get all these things right. All right. There's so many times I have to try to remember here. All right. Here, he talks about very clearly. And what do you kind of get your views on? Because you've talked about, you know, where we're at and future of this country. And this is a battle of a much bigger war. And he talks to the fact that there is a point of no return in America as well when it comes to the balkanization, the separation of our, let's say, of our society. And he says we may be nearing it, and we may even be past it. And I think that this, you know, is a very interesting point. You've talked about this, you know, where we're talking about the balkanization. We're talking about, you know, have we are reaching that breaking point where we can no longer be one country, and we're dealing with, and you kind of brought your own fear to that. So what you know, when you read that or heard that, you know, what's your thoughts?
Well, I think it's true. I think we are on the verge of redoing, if you will, the United States of America, and I think that the whole idea of replacing our culture, which the byword of our culture is freedom, and what we're talking about is freedom in many ways. You know, there's freedom from, and there's freedom to. Freedom from is where the major conflicts of human history have been. You know, freedom from sickness, freedom from poverty, freedom from starvation, freedom from oppression, and freedom from all of the limitation, freedom from human work, or at least demeaning human work. And if you get all freedom from all this, what is left? Well, then it's freedom for, Freedom for what? Freedom for opportunity. Freedom for the right to choose your light, your mate, your mother, your husband or wife. Freedom to choose what your children's schools and what their curriculum should be. Freedom is the byword of our entire culture, and freedom of opportunity, and freedom for everybody. Freedom, no matter what your race or color or creed or disposition is. And so, what we're talking about now is we're talking about freedom, which is dependent upon the government. And that means no freedom at all. And ultimately, if all of these, if the nanny state that we see starting to be openly encouraged and attempt to put it into law, where everybody depends upon the state, and the state is not the people that we necessarily elect. They are the people that we are forced to accommodate. It's really the bureaucratic state and not the democratic state. And if this is our future, then we're getting close to what I consider closer to the Nazis than we are to the communists. And this is really a critical time in the history of the United States of America. And so when Barack Obama talks about the phony state or these false discussions about the culture, and says we don't have time for that, what we have to do is take care of the current needs, he's talking about he thinks we've got a bunch of freedoms from that we haven't accomplished yet. He wants to make sure that the state takes care and tells us what kind of education we should have and what kind of industries we should have and so on. And he's purpose. I think he's got to be purpose. He's a smart guy. He's got to be. He's purposely trying to obscure the primary thrust of the entire Democrat Party the way it is now. And this, I feel, if we don't win this next election, that we may have lost our last chance, because these people are serious. They're fanatic in many ways, and they are not breaching. They broach no dispute or no dissent. Their idea of trying to dialogue with their enemy, with the people that don't agree with them, is you must destroy them. It isn't you must convert them, or you must try to accommodate them, or must learn how to live with them. They're trying to destroy them, and in that sense, they're very close to a totalitarian mentality.
Well, yeah, like I said, you're definitely making some very valid points that need to be listened to, because that's we're at that how far can we continue to? Because we really, when you have people literally saying it's time for two Americas to separate out, I find myself, and we're having people actually having this conversation. That's a serious issue where you have that much dissatisfaction with what's happening here. And here, let me take this even a step further here, because this, because I wanted to kind of go into that, but take this even a step further, because McCulloch and Obama are making another argument that's often made, but it is, okay, for example, McCulloch says, okay, listen to me, I'm going to spend billions of dollars on education. I'm going to hire more teachers, more this, more that. And you see the same thing with what Obama's doing. You know, he's basically saying, you know, we are going to solve big problems together. We're going to rebuild our society, make a better life. And when it comes down to the education side, we're going to be spending money. And whereas I think the Youngkin campaign is caught on to, and a lot of Republicans are caught on to, is there are a lot of things in education that is more than just about dollars and cents, but it was actually being taught in the schools. I mean, this was a, from the Washington Post, where they had a series of, somehow this guy got some inside information by two Republican senators that talked about an internal poll of battleground states. 78% agreed with the statement, many public school systems are failing and children are falling behind. 65% agreed that biological males to compete against women in high school and college sports is hugely unfair and will erase many of the gains that women have made in athletics. 58% agree that critical race theory should not be taught because children should not be told that they're inherently racist based on the color of their skin. Traditionally, Democrats have held advantages in education, but the parental anger and learning loss caused by school closure has shifted the landscape. And many moms and dads are now looking at the teachers' unions as the main problem. Mask mandates may pull well, but they also add to the tension. And this is, again, it goes back to, you listen to this, and what we're hearing from Republicans, or let's say, and this campaign in Virginia, which ought to be something we should be thinking about, is we want to know what's happening in the classroom. It's not just about, hey, you can hire as many teachers as you want, but if you have garbage going into the classroom, it benefits nobody. It's what's going on in the actual learning process itself. And I know you and I had this conversation about, was it a week ago or 2 weeks ago? I can't remember when. you know, with your ophthalmologist friend, who's a school board member, and, you know, we all three, you know, talk about the fact that a lot of parents got to see what was actually going on in the classroom when they were basically sitting at home watching their kids on the Zoom lesson. And I'm thinking,
right. Exactly.
Yeah, that had to be an eye opener for quite a few parents. Like, they're teaching what? Did I just hear that correctly? And then when the teachers union essentially said, hey, yeah, we want to keep getting paid for not having to teach kids, and we want to keep them out of school. And this is a point that our mutual friend stated, and by the way, our mutual friend's a Democrat, that this people were falling behind on these test scores. This was not aiding them. This was hurting them. And that at least a third of these kids weren't even getting educated at all. But I just think it's an interesting switch because we're no longer talking about spending money. We're actually talking about what goes on in the classroom. Your thoughts?
Well, I thought it was, I mean, just to be a little bit realistic here, I thought it was the height of arrogance and stupidity when the teachers decided that they wanted to be paid, but they didn't want to work. And I mean, who in the world has ever tried to pull that off for any in any environment? They really got away with it in many cases because they did get paid, they didn't work, and the ones that did work were absolutely over didn't know. Most teachers have never had any experience either as students, and let alone as practitioners of distance learning. They knew nothing about it, so they had to work very hard to come up with lesson plans and whatever, and technology and so on, and so they didn't want to do it, so they didn't do it. They said they didn't say we don't want to teach. They said we don't want to catch COVID-19. So who is going to argue with them? Well, a lot of people started arguing with them, and then even after the vaccine had become very easily obtained, they still didn't want to work. Once you get that kind of arrogance, and then you start finding out that what they're teaching is so anti-American, and that they're not, a lot of them, of course, didn't like it, but they did it, and they taught what they were told to teach, but the arrogance of that whole community now, I mean, this used to be the approach that college professors were taking. You know, they had under academic freedom that you're supposed to be able to say whatever you want, and everybody's supposed to give you. They might disagree with you, but they die for your opportunity to do it, your right to do it. And now that's spread down to K-12, and it's just becoming over. In fact, I think, frankly, if the traditional Americans prevail here in the next 4 to 6 years, I think that the attitudes that the American population general have about education in public and having the government run our schools is fast dissipating. And I think we may be having the very first chance in our lives to have free school choice. Go ahead.
Hold on a second. Yeah. Hold on a second. This is Tom Bowson, Bowson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
You might know me. I'm 50 Cent. You may follow my tweets, my Facebook friends. Odds are a few in 6 degrees separate us. We're that close. What's crazy is 1 in 6 don't know where their next meal is coming from. These are your coworkers, your neighbors, your friends. Hunger's too close for us to ignore. So visit feedingamerica.org/hunger and find your local food bank to see how you can make a difference. From one close friend to another, let's do this. I'm 50 Cent, and together we are Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America.
I never get the flu.
My kids don't need more shots.
I don't have time.
We're all healthy.
My asthma's under control.
I'm pregnant. I've had the flu. It's not a big deal.
My kids are too old for flu.
The media is exaggerating.
I can fight it naturally.
No matter how you build your excuses, the flu can blow your house down. Keep your foundation strong. Vaccinate. Learn more at flu.gov.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Confessions of a Potentially Perfect Parent, brought to you by AdoptUsKids.org.
I might look like an adult, like a person who could possibly be a parent, but I have no idea how to talk like one. And everyone knows that if you want to be a parent, you have to sound good when you say things like, "Don't make me turn this car around," or "Because I said so," or "Don't make me come back there." I don't even really know what those things mean, but I know that I actually believed my parents when they said them to me. How did they manage to sound so convincing? Here we go. "Don't make me come back there." Oh, no, that's not tough enough at all. Kids can sense weakness. "Don't make me come back there." Ooh, yeah, that's better. In fact, that kind of sounded like my dad. Weird.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who would love to listen to you practice your dad voice. Call 1-888-200-4005 or visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. This message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to Dawson Files here on the Bachelor News Radio Network with my good friend and the co-host, I should say the main host, in which I'm just simply number 2 in command of the Resistance Hour, every 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on this network every Wednesday. And tomorrow, are we still working on tomorrow's show? Do we have a guest yet?
You said you were going to get one.
Okay, yeah. So we're still working on it. All right. So, yeah, okay. Back to where we're at. And don't forget, tomorrow on the Donaldson Files, Maury Richards comes back for the second part, Policing in the 21st Century. And you're making a very good point, and I want to kind of follow up. You know, like, I think for the first time in a long time, you know, parents are seeing, you know, what's behind the curtain. You're kind of like
The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, The Wizard of Oz. They're seeing what's behind the curtain and being exposed to it and being exposed to some of the arrogance. I mean, I think to me, it'd be interesting to see what happens in Virginia, because to me, what I was seeing from a long, you know, to me, it had to be, I'm hoping it was the last straw, or it should be a last straw, when you have the Attorney General of the country basically saying, you know, treating parents to go to school board meetings as domestic terrorists, or the equivalent thereof. I mean, when governments are, when your own federal government is basically saying to you, how dare you question your education, you domestic terrorist?
And that is freedom from.
Yeah, exactly. Because this is why we have a constitution to begin with, so that government understands it is limited in its power. Limited in its power. And I think this is one of, it's like the wake-up call where you basically have your own government basically saying, if you dare to question the edict of the education bureaucracy and demand that you have a say in what your kids get educated on, I mean, I have to be honest with you. When this happened, my first thought is, what is going on that somebody thought this was a brilliant idea, politically speaking?
Well, you know, it's the whole thing is just very, very, we are on the edge. We're on the precipice of, we take one more step, I think we're over the, we're going to go over the edge. And we've got to get together and stop these fanatics. These people are just incredibly. I think they're evil. It's not necessarily that they're evil people, but what it is that they are. What they do is evil. It's evil from the point of view of traditional American freedom. It is injurious to our culture if we want to rebut Mr. Obama, and we have to realize that we're in trouble, and we've got to do something about it. And so many people are just. They don't like it, but they don't really make much of a difference in terms of their own behavior, you know. And I guess I'm getting on a pulpit here, but I just don't like it at all. I'm scared of it.
Yeah. Well, but here's now I'm going to go to another subject here. I'm going to kind of switch to a little bit, but this quote got. This was the science, I guess this the individual is running the European Union Research Council, and this was the question asked of her: do you think it would be better to keep politics out of sight? And she said, "It is the prerogative of elected governments to determine what goes on in their constituents. If a science is part of that, then they should have a say." Then she adds this. This, to me, is the crest of the arrogance that we see with a good portion of our bureaucracy and scientific lab. But politicians who are not trained in science should not meddle in our day-to-day business or tell scientists what is right or wrong. I would see it as my duty to explain to politicians what's best and to get them to realize that. They distribute the money, so we have to make them understand what's good for the people, you know, rather than say stay out. I thought, you know, I'm going to repeat the last portions again. Politicians who are not trained in science should not meddle in our day-to-day business or tell scientists what is right, what is wrong. We should see it as my duty to explain to politicians what's best and get them to realize that they should distribute the money, but we have to make them understand what's good for the people. Your thoughts?
Well, she's talking about the role or the value of pure research, isn't she? And
I'm not.
So I think what she's, saying, at least the context I thought, was that she is saying that when the public policy gets around to needing science, that they ought to listen to the scientists and not try to educate or legislate against what the scientists think is right. And it sounded to me like a case in point would be what we're trying to do now in terms of COVID, that the politicians have taken over the whole idea of this pandemic, and they're trying to make rules about it, laws about it, and really they're not paying any attention to what the science is telling them.
I totally disagree with that, because I have the complete opposite dealing with COVID, that the scientists themselves got the science wrong, and that the politicians found themselves depending upon bad science to make bad policy. And maybe here's the thing, it comes to me. What tells scientists what's right and what's wrong? Well, you have a Tony Fauci who got a good portion of the science wrong, and we based our policies on that. And scientists by themselves don't always agree on a lot of issues. And essentially what we have is a scientific class that says, okay, this is what we want you to believe. That's how I interpret it. It's like the way she put it. We have to make them understand what's good for people. Well, if the science is wrong, they're going to get it wrong. I mean, politicians use the bureaucrat and the science to enhance government control, in my view. But the they got it from Tony Fauci, as an example. And I think this is, to me, what scares me in that regard is that, this is how you end up with funding gain-of-function research or torturing puppies for scientific research. I know what you're saying to an extent, but I found this to be more arrogant than I found, as opposed to saying, well, don't interfere with and let the scientific process work. But but when you have scientists saying, this is what we're finding, we expect you need to be doing this based on that. Unless you get the science right, policy.
I think you're assuming that Tony Fauci is a scientist. Tony Fauci is not following the science himself, and I think that the Biden administration is not following anything scientific at all. They're changing their tune about every 2 weeks, and it's all based upon politics, as far as I can tell.
Well, I would agree with that, but to me, science, I'm going to put it this way. I truly believe that there are scientists who will compromise their science to fulfill their political agenda or whatever agenda they may have. We see this with climate change. we are seeing this with the COVID restrictions. I mean, this was not based on a bunch of politicians saying, let's do it. This was based on people claiming in the name of science we need to be doing this. And we still have people in the name of science. And this is what you end up with. Is, I guess the question is, if you could trust scientists to be scientists, here's the facts, here's what we suggest, and go from there, and then let the political process work itself out. Now, what happens when the scientific community itself is driven by politics?
Well, and that's what we've got in climate change.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there is a good answer. I think that if you were really, really being scientific and following the general ethics of any science, any empirical science anyway, that you, even if you're a politician, what you would want to do is you would want to take what all of the consensus of the scientists is. First of all, you do what DeSantis did. You go and study the thing yourself, and you'd also take a look at all of the various opinions and research and data that you could, and then you pick out, you use it as an advisory tool, and you pick out what you think is right. And you check it out with the people you respect in the field, and then you go forward with it. I think he's doing it exactly right. And this woman that we're talking about, if that's what she has in mind, if DeSantis comes to her and says, you know, what is the scientific consensus in nuclear physics on this particular topic? And she happens to know, or she can find it and help him. She ought to do it. I didn't get the impression she's saying that the politicians ought to follow everything that scientists say, as so much as we need to educate the politicians about what the issues really are.
Yeah.
But
I interpret it differently. Mainly because I have. You know, watching the last 17, 18 months and listening, you know, and having the quote-unquote experts basically allow political facts, the political narrative to get in the way of their science. And that's what I've always feared. I've written about this in my original book, and in my upcoming book, I'm going to continue to follow up on the idea. I mean, that's how I interpret it. I know you're basically saying that, you know, that basically she says, we'll give you the best advice and go from there. I just think, quite frankly, there's a touch of, I just felt that there was a touch of arrogance in what she stated. So maybe, you know, again, we're having different interpretation of what she's saying.
Well, no matter what she's saying, I still think that's the best way for them to go. I think, you know, if you've got a tough question, you go to the people that are supposed to know the most about it. You try to figure out what they're talking about, and then you put it together with what you think is real, and you go on from there.
Hold on. Yeah, well, I thought this was, thank you a lot, Larry, for coming in at the last minute. Coco Kosky mentioned to me she had some kidney stones yesterday, and she's on pain medications. And so she was didn't think it would be a good idea to be high in pain medication, be on the show. So hopefully next week she'll be ready to come back on. This is Tom Donaldson, Donaldson Files. You and the Law follows next here on the Donaldson Files and the Batchelor News Radio Network.
want to thank everyone for tuning in and joining you and the Law Podcast Show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We hope everybody is having a great day. We've got a good show, a good topic that we're going to be talking about. This month is October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and so today we're going to have on a guest who is going to be talking to us about domestic violence. She is a survivor of domestic violence, and she is also the president of Aunt Mom's Basic Tribe Foundation. So we are definitely going to be honored to have on the podcast show Miss Helena, and I want to make sure I get that pronounced that name right, because I was police chief in Helena, West Helena, Arkansas, and her name is so close to Helena. So we want to make sure that I get the name right. So again, we want to remind all of our listeners that the call-in number to the show is 646-929-0130. That's 646-929-0130. And if you miss any parts of this live broadcast, definitely go to thebachelornews.airtime.pro. That's thebachelornews.airtime.pro. And to listen to the rebroadcast of the You and the Law podcast show. So we're going to join our guest, Ms. Helena, who's going to talk to us about domestic violence, because this is something that is definitely a big topic that's going on in the African American community, and it's something that definitely impacts a lot of women, but also men are also victims of domestic violence as well. And so, Helena, we are glad that you are able to come on the show and talk to us about domestic violence.
Thank you. I am.
Are you
can
there
you
with
me?
Us? Yeah.
I'm
yes,
here.
I can.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, I was saying that I'm honored to be on the show.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. And I know this is a topic that is very that is near to you, because you are a survivor of domestic violence, and you know it takes a lot of courage for someone who has been a victim of domestic violence to come out and to speak openly and publicly about the things that they experience. But, you know, so I want to say this before we go any further. You know, I don't know if you saw this video, but we talked about it on our podcast show a few weeks ago. There was a disturbing video incident that took place in Philadelphia where a lady was sexually assaulted on a train, where so many people watched and actually took out their phones to film this incident. And I guess to me that really was where is our society at when we are talking about domestic violence and sexual assault, and how people are just so numb to it, and if they see it, they don't do anything to prevent it from happening, or they don't do anything to report it to law enforcement. So, you know, we're going to be talking about a lot of these different topics, why our black churches are not involved in domestic violence outreach. But start off telling us, how did you form this nonprofit organization called Aunt Mom's Basic Tribe Foundation?
Well, I formed this foundation because I am a mother of four children, and I'm also an aunt of several children that I happened to raise. My mom would always say that I raised more children than I had. And so basic tribe is something that I came up with as far as we would always say it takes a tribe or it takes a community to raise children. So we put together Aunt Mom Basic Tribe. But my heart in this foundation is domestic violence, homelessness, and also, most importantly, children. It breaks my heart to see any child out there in need for anything. As a domestic violence survivor, homelessness is one thing that happens because when you leave, you have no place to go. If you want to survive, you end up on the streets. So homelessness is very near and dear to my heart as well. And
okay.
So with
okay.
this organization, those are some of the things that we want to combat. We want to combat homelessness. We want to combat domestic violence. We want to combat hunger. We just are out in the community trying to do all of the community work we can possibly do in those areas.
Okay. Okay. And as you know, I mean, when we talk about domestic violence, you know, it impacts, you know, the children that's in the home. It also impacts other extended family members. But one of the things that if a person is a victim of domestic violence, they may have to leave the home. There may not be a women's shelter that they can go to. And oftentimes, especially in the law enforcement, we've seen women who they resort to sleeping in the car. So they're basically homeless unless they can go stay with a family member. Have you noticed anything like that? Because you're in Little Rock, Arkansas. So have you noticed anything like that as you're out doing your work in the community?
That is definitely one part of our work. You can go under a bridge. The Little Rock was the Little Rock Bridge. That bridge is Little Rock to North Little Rock. And you find mm-hmm. families there. It is mothers with their children running away trying. They're homeless. They have no place to go. The families wouldn't take them in because they didn't want to be a part of what was going on over at that house. You know, in our community, we have this thing called, you know, what happens in our house stays in our house, and that kind of drifts out into life, I guess, for a woman that is trying to run away from domestic violence because she has to run away with her children, and she ends up on the streets, her and her children.
Yeah.
And so what we do, we provide transportation and maybe some emergency shelter and try to give them resources to shelters that could possibly help them move into maybe some HUD housing or something like that.
Oh, okay, okay. Well, Helena, we're going to be about to come up on our first break. And I want to remind our listeners, if you're just now tuning into the show, this is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. October is every year. And so, you know, here on You and the Law podcast show, we want to also be a part of raising the awareness of domestic violence because it's often a topic that is not talked about a lot in the Black community. And, you know, Helena, you know, everyone knows someone who has been a victim of domestic violence. And also, mm-hmm. men can also become victims of domestic violence. But we're going to take our first break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the conversation of everyone knows someone, but you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
You know, two directors are shining a light on survivors of abuse. And So I Stayed is an award-winning documentary about three survivors who strikingly have similar stories and were separated by 30 years. They all point to how no one believed their stories about their abuse, and each ended up behind bars together to fight back. Here's a clip.
We all had police reports, hospital records, witness statements, pictures of violations. For God's sake, Nikki's abuser raped her and uploaded it to a porn site. What more evidence do you need? Why didn't my hospital records matter? Why didn't Nikki's hospital records matter? Why didn't Tanisha's hospital records matter? Why didn't my police reports matter? Why didn't Nikki's police reports matter? Why didn't Tanisha's police reports matter? Why didn't my scars, bruises, and marks on me matter? Why didn't Nikki's matter? Why didn't Tanisha's matter? Why does it not matter? What happens to us?
Wow. Powerful. Well, it matters to us because we're talking about it. Joining me now as we honor Domestic Violence Awareness Month, the film's directors, Natalie Battillo and Daniel Nelson, as well as formerly incarcerated survivor and advocate Kim Brown. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Natalie, what inspired you to make this film?
Well, it started out of my own experiences of being a survivor of domestic violence. And also in 2010, my sister was killed by her abuser. And when I went to grad school at Columbia, I knew that I wanted to cover domestic violence. And that was back in 2015. And there was a advisor who sort of I told my personal story to and said, why don't you cover the story about survivors who are criminalized for fighting back? And in my mind, it just like did not make sense that we were putting survivors behind bars for their acts of survival, whether it was self-defense or being coerced to commit a crime by their abuser. You know, survivors often feel like it's a life or death situation, and it really is. So since then, I decided that I would continue to report that, and that's how I learned about Kim and her incredible work with New York's Domestic Violence Survivors Justice Act. I had also at that time sent my story to Dan, who's co-director, and I'll let him sort of speak to how he came on, and then obviously let Kim speak about her experience as well.
You got it. I'll guide the conversation. Kim, you know, you were incarcerated for 17 years for killing your abusive husband. Why? What was it? What was it you lacked? What was it that you weren't getting? Who wasn't hearing you that caused you or pushed you to the point where you felt like that was your only option?
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for having us this morning. I think it's the lack of a trauma-informed approach when you bring your abuser to the courtroom. I had five arrest warrants for Darnell. I had hospital records, police reports, battered women's shelter reports. I had him arrested five times, but none of that seemed to matter at court. And every time we went to court, you know, I was the upset, hysterical woman that no one was really paying attention to. And he would stand there and say how he doesn't want anything to do with me. And then as soon as we would get outside, he would be right there grabbing me by the little fat roll on my side, pinching me hard, saying, come on, let's go. So it was a lack of support from the system. You know, I went to the court. I filed police reports. I did everything I thought I was supposed to do to be safe, and no one kept me safe.
It's just, it's heartbreaking just hearing that. And unfortunately, we hear these types of stories far too often. And Daniel, my guess is you were pretty surprised to hear many things about these survivors and within Kim's story and others. Do you think this doc can make a difference? Do you think this is finally kind of the angle, the feel, the emotion, the characters that can drive home why something has to be done to protect women like Kim?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when I first started this and Natalie showed me this the story, which was originally Kim's story in a version of her master's thesis, I was really blown away by how prevalent this issue was, being criminalized for defending yourself against your abuser. And Natalie's an incredible writer and journalist, so the story was incredible. And Kim is one of those people who just sort of jumps off the page when you read about her. And yeah, I feel like documentary film is a medium that is very impactful for talking about issues like this. And I just hope that people walk away from this film understanding that I think folks have a tendency to just trust that the legal system is doing the right thing. And in many cases, it does not, particularly with domestic violence survivors. And so I hope that people can watch this film and see that.
Agreed. And Natalie, you know, the New York Times covered how your film actually played a role in Tanisha Davis's case. She's featured in the film, which resulted in freedom after a conviction. What was that like for you? And does it show you just the power of what your filmmaking can do?
It really does. It really does show us the power of, you know, storytelling and survivors using their voice. We were honored to be a part of that process. We worked with Tanisha and her lawyers to put together a video statement with her application to be resentenced under this new law that, you know, Kim had fought for 10 years. So it was a day that I will never forget. And, you know, there's still women behind bars like Tanisha. There's Nikki Adamando, who faced a 19 to life sentence. So, you know, the work is not done. Although that was, you know, very uplifting for us, we still hope to free more survivors, whether it's through educating, you know, the legal system, trainings, you know, and just empathy. Like, really, truly, it's like these are people's lives. These survivors have hopes and dreams. They, you know, are not a true crime story. They should not be reduced to that. And there's real nuance that should be explored in learning about domestic violence. And I hope that our film can contribute to that conversation.
Well, it already has, and you're helping women get their power back. Kim, Natalie, Daniel, thank you so much. And Natalie, your strength is so amazing. Appreciate all three of you for what you're doing.
Thank you
for having us.
Hi, everyone. George Stephan.
Hey, I want to welcome everyone back to You and the Law broadcast show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We just listened to a news clipping related to domestic violence and what women experience when they report domestic violence. And I think it was real important to play that whole entirety of that news clip just so our listeners can understand just the what women experience and what they go through. And Helena, I think it's real important that, you know, to have somebody like you on the show who has being a survivor of domestic violence, it just you can actually speak to how some of those women in that news article, in that news clip, as to the same thing that you may have experienced.
Absolutely, the part where, you know, they beat you and they beat you in a way that they don't leave bruises, and the police come and they say, you know, he's not going to go to jail. I don't see a bruise on him, on you. And if you finally get a bruise, you're beaten so bad. When you finally go to court, you know, the judge is, where's your restraining order? That, you know, these days, those restraining orders is
just a piece of paper.
And those guys, they don't care anything about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, hey, Helena, I want to also remind our listeners that if you're just now tuning into the show, if you're on the phone or if you're online listening at blogtalkradio.com/LA Bachelor, if you're in the chat room, if you would like to come on the show, let the producer know. He screened the calls. If you got a comment or a question or just like to even share your experience of what you may have went through being a victim of domestic violence, just let him know and he'll put you on the show with us. Or if you just got a question, send your questions in the chat room. And if you just like to listen to the show, please do so. But just want to let you know that if you are on the line on the phone listening or online listening, if you'd like to come on, well, more than welcome to have you join in on the conversation, because I think this is a real important conversation. And, you know, even though, you know, Helena, you know, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but this is a, as you know, a 365-day every woman or men or and people in the LGBTQ community, they deal with this. So this isn't just something that only, you know, we just talk about it in October, but it's something that occurs every single day throughout the year.
Absolutely. And you hit on the LGBTQ community. That community is so forgotten. They have such a high rate of domestic violence and a high rate of homelessness due to domestic violence. And they are really a society when it comes to that, because nobody realizes that, you know, it happens to women, to men in relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Man-on-man relationship, women-on-women relationship, domestic violence. I call domestic violence the silent killer of women and partners. It is equivalent to a stroke because no one wants to talk about it. There's a big stigma about domestic violence. You don't want to be that weak person that is being beat on. You don't want to talk about it. It's a big secret.
Yeah, it is. And you know, the statistics are really disturbing when you look at some of the statistics that is available, where, you know, over 41% of black women have been physically abused by a partner during their lifetime. And these statistics come from the National Crime Victim Survey, which is NCVS. And one of the things that stood out to me, Helena, was between 2003 and 2012, at a rate of 4.7% or 1,000 black women or African-American had the highest rate of intimate partner violence compared to a white woman, which was 3.9 per 1,000, and the Hispanics was about 2.3 per 1,000. So you can see the disparities between the different races of black women, white women, and Latinos.
Yeah, definitely. There is, when you're out on the street and you're doing any kind of community work, you will see more women of color out there for those exact reasons. Because, again, in our culture, it's what happens in my house stays in my house, and I don't want that mess in my house. So they have no place to go but to the streets. And it's we have huge disparities in a lot of things. And Arkansas, on that list, I think we rank 35 in domestic violence.
Wow, wow. Well, you know, one of the things that, and, you know, we talked about this before the show, and we're going to talk about it before the show ends, is that it's silent in the black community. And one of the things that's very disturbing, and I hope we have some pastors who are listening to the show, because in the church, this is something that, and I'm going to share this number with you. Sadly, 37% of pastors surveyed say that they believe that domestic and sexual violence does not occur in their congregations. But Helena, we're coming up on our next break, and we're going to take this break, and we come back, we're going to get back into the conversation about domestic violence awareness in the month of October. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
If you've got a clogged up nose, Simply Stuffy. If you've got a snuffly nose, Simply Stuffy. If the rest of you feel fine, but your nose is out of line, give your schnozzle what it needs, Simply Stuffy.
Simply Stuffy, from the makers of Children's Tylenol. It has only the medicine your child needs to make a stuffy nose simply disappear.
If you want to smell a rose, get the stuff out of your nose. If you're sick or feeling snotty, Simply Stuffy.
Simply Stuffy. Use as directed.
back to the Bachelor News Radio Network and, of course, the show You and the Law, the You and the Law broadcast with Chief Virgil Green, Chief Humphrey, off this evening. He's off and, of course, dealing with the topic of domestic violence in this month of October, being the Domestic Violence Month. Don't forget, if you miss this broadcast, you can go to the website, and we see a bunch of folks on listening at the Bachelor news.airtime.pro, the Bachelor news.airtime.pro. You can listen to the rebroadcast of this show. And of course, if you have questions, if you're on the 646-929-0130 number line, we will be screening, I will be screening the calls and ask you if you have questions or comments of this topic, this guest, this host. And of course, you can make your comment known in the chat room. I want Chief to ask a two-part question to Sister Helena. Sister, I appreciate you coming on, and I think this is a very important topic, and this might not be the most popular question, but I will ask that if you are in a situation as a man, and men tend to go through verbal abuse, police officers and law enforcement, as the chief is discussing in that realm, have to deal with a lot of the physicality. Certainly, I've seen in my own family men being physical with women, but I've also seen situations where women might be overly intoxicated, right? And then they fight. And then conventional wisdom is, from a society standpoint, is that you take the man out of the house. He might have all the scratches and the beat down, but you take him away because society says that the man is, in most cases, more physical. You take him away. So what do you say about those situations, those rare situations where women are the aggressive and they're beating that, you know what, out of the dude, and the dude has to go through those things? And then the second part of it is, I think, especially in our culture, you mentioned that, sis and chief, is that we just say stop doing it. Like, just leave. Like, dude is beating the hell out of you, just leave. But that it's not that simple. So what do you say to people that don't seem to understand that in our culture, whether we're in our culture or outside the culture, that we don't get it? Like, for women, it's just not that simple. You just leave. It's mental, a lot of different things and dynamics that go into it that people don't seem to society to understand, such that you just don't leave. It's a lot goes into all of that that people don't really understand. Two part, if you will.
The first part, the man, I can't speak on the man part simply because I'm not a man, but I have seen men beaten before. And I think domestic violence is wrong, whether it's a woman dishing it or receiving it. The second part of the question I can address, because as a domestic violence survivor, I can tell you just leaving is just not what you can do. For me,
thank you.
I said, and I thought, I'm sorry.
Thank you. I hear a lot of women that don't, the people that have never experienced it, just say just leave. So thank you for saying that.
You can't just leave, because you, mentally, as you said, you're thinking about, for me, I was 18, 19 years old. I felt accomplished. I was in college. I had just bought a house full of furniture. I had a new car, and this man would beat me every day. And just leave? oh my God, I got to leave my furniture. I got to leave my car. Where am I going to go? You have no place to go. You don't want to be on the street. But when I woke up in the hospital with my child dead and my face looking like a pumpkin head, that's when it was too late to leave. But I had to go. I had no other choice. And for women with children, it's absolutely the last thing you think about is, I'm going to leave because I have no place to go, and I don't want my children to sleep in a car, and I don't want them to be hungry, and they know what's going on, but maybe if I hide it again, you know, or, you know, not let them hear it, then it'll go away. And it doesn't go away. It escalates. Because if they hit you once, it's going to continue, and it escalates. It really does.
And Chief, just let me get out of your way, but just to follow up with that, that's got to be hard because if you come across someone that might have a sense of embarrassment or whatever the case may be as a woman in that situation, you're trying to help, but you're a responder, right? So you're not there and you're going to do this and you're going to give them some numbers for whatever. You might have some stuff for shelters, but you're not, you know what I mean? You're there to respond. You're not there to be the social worker and all that. You could arrest somebody if it's on spot, but it makes it difficult. I would think, Chief Green, that you have to be able to be all those things, and that's really not your position. Although you wanted to be, that maybe not be your position of where you have to go and the short-term, the immediate response.
Yeah. Well, in L.A., and I think in to the listener, you know, one of the things, you know, you mentioned that police officers aren't the social workers. They're not all the other things that you mentioned. But more often, officers are put in a situation where they are. They respond to calls that are domestic-related. You're dealing with multiple situations going on inside the home. If there's children inside the home, you're dealing with children. Depending upon the age of the victim or the suspect. So there's a lot of different things that a police officer is dealing with, and you're trying to decide which is the best. How do you deal with this situation the best? Now, in a lot of states, you know, if a police officer sees a sign that either the man or the woman has signs of any kind of injury, you know, most likely somebody's going to go to jail. And, you know, oftentimes it's the woman who has the injuries. But, you know, the talk about the where men are the victims of domestic violence, I will tell you, I don't, you know, in my time of being a patrol officer and now, you know, being in administrative level, you don't see a lot of resources for men to go somewhere to get away from the you know, their wife or their girlfriend. The only alternative.
And Chief, let me just say that I didn't mean to cut you off because I'm getting some pushback on and at no place, as I mentioned to Sis Helena and I never said that there is some balance, God forbid, in terms of men and women domestic violence. I never said that. I just asked a question. The only reason I asked a question to you, Sis, and to Chief, is that the fact is that my brother, I was in the midst of something where my brother was getting beat the hell out of by his woman, his wife, who was intoxicated. And I would be, to both of you, it'd be 3 a.m, I get a call like, hey, I need you to come get me. He's got all these bruises on his face, right? And the cops are like, you need come get him or he's going to jail. And he would be like, I mean, they would get into it. I'm just being real. They get into it. She'd be sober enough. He'd have all the bruises and he was going to go to jail. That's the only reason I brought it up. And in those rare, and I said that, in those rare situations, you might have a woman that might get away with that, and that's the situation. I never said it was any balance or any creed to the fact that men are not getting as abused as women. I never said that. I was just making that point. But I was also saying is that to the both of you is that culturally we all as black people, I think that we just say stop doing it or just leave him or whatever the case may be. And to your guest, I'm just saying it's not that simple either way, whether my brother keeps going back to his ex-wife and she keeps getting him in trouble, or to your guest who unfortunately thank God she got out of it, but that it's not that simple is my point, is what I was really trying to say. And then you as a police chief bringing your officers involved, you're playing, you know, social workers. And nothing, there's a no-win at all in any of that, Chief Green. And that's all I was really saying, to the point of people hitting me saying, oh, you know, sticking up for the guys and all this kind of stuff, and that wasn't the case.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I know we got a lot of people on the line listening to the show, because this is, you know, a topic that is not often talked about. And if it is talked about, it's talked about behind closed doors. It's not talked about a lot out in open. And Helena, one of the things that, you know, we talked about that I mentioned earlier was the LGBTQ community. What has been your experience being a victim of domestic violence, being an advocate for domestic violence, dealing with people that are homeless, when you have the same, sex, you know, where you have a woman, two women who are in an abusive relationship, or you have two men who are in an abusive relationship? What has been your experience dealing with the same type of same-sex domestic violence?
I will say that I had a very close friend that was gay, and he was dating this guy that would beat him every weekend when he started drinking. And he would never, ever leave this guy because, one, the stigma of being gay is already big.
Oh, yeah.
Two, now we've added domestic violence. So now we're saying you're gay and you're getting beat on. So everything was swallowed in for him. He stayed until the guy beat him into having a stroke and left him. Usually in the what I've seen in the LGBTQ community is they stay until the abuser leaves, if it's not too late and they're beat to death. That has been my experience.
Okay.
It's really detrimental.
Okay. Well, hey, Helena, we're getting ready to come up and take our next break, but I want to remind our listeners, for all of those who are on the line or on the chat room, if you got any comments or questions, please leave those with the producer. We'll get those answered on air. But we're talking with our guest, Helena. This is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. But we're going to, when we come out of this break, we're going to talk about how silent the black community is, especially our churches, related to domestic violence. But you're listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.
Welcome to Total Wine & More. It's much more than a wine store. It's the eighth wonder of the world.
When people talk about Total Wine & More, they get a little carried away. We're just a big, friendly place run by people with a passion for wine, beer, and spirits.
8,000 different wines, 2,500 different beers, 3,000 spirits, and friendly, helpful experts at every turn.
You know what? Maybe we are the eighth wonder of the world.
Shop in store or online at TotalWine.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, want to welcome everyone back to You and the Law broadcast show on the Bachelor News Radio Network, where today we have on a special guest who is the president of a nonprofit organization that does community outreach related to domestic violence in Little Rock, Arkansas. And so she is also a survivor of domestic violence, and she is here sharing with us her story and how her nonprofit organization is out in the community in Little Rock, Arkansas, helping men, women, and people who are with the LGBTQ community who are fall victims to domestic violence, where they become homelessness, they become homeless, and there's not a lot of resources out there to assist them. So, you know, we definitely thank you for taking the time to come on the show and talk to us about this important topic. And, you know, I'll say this. I think, you know, this is something that, you know, I would like to do another show on, because I think, you know, just the amount of time that we have, you're not able to cover a lot related to this. And I think this is something that, you know, even just sharing it on our social media platforms, there wasn't a lot of people who really engaged. There were some people who engaged, but not a lot of people engaged. And it's kind of concerning, Helena, where, you know, people can get on TikTok and, man, they'll like something, or, you know, next thing you know, it's gotten over thousands and thousands of likes or reviews. But when we talk about domestic violence, it's just people are just quiet about it.
Okay. It's the taboo of it. I feel that, you know, it's the secret killer. No one wants to talk about what's a secret.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah.
And you know,
social media,
early...
I'm sorry, what I have to say about social media, you know, you were talking about the lady that was getting filmed being raped. And
yes.
In this society now, it is normal to just pick up your phone and record a tragedy instead of being someone to intervene, to say, stop, let me dial 911. And it is crazy. It is just absolutely insane. But that's our culture now.
Yeah, it is. And I tell you, you know, the came out, it was just very disturbing to know that so many people did not jump in to assist this woman and to prevent what was happening. And, you know, we've got people, you know, you always hear the about New York. Oh, well, you know, people will walk over somebody who's dead, or people are just in such a, you know, rush to get to where they're going. And there's so much that they see that this is just like everyday. It's common to them, but we've seen just with the, you know, with the surge of social media, with TikTok, with, you know, Facebook, with, you know, Instagram and so many other things, where people are uploading videos of people that they don't even know, and they're sharing this violence with everybody, but they're not doing anything to stop it. And even inside of the schools, where we've seen, you know, students, you know, girls who have become victims of domestic violence in schools, and, you know, the videos are shared through social media. But I want to get to something I brought up as we were going to break. And I know it's going to hit, you know, a nerve with some people, but I think this is just part of the conversation. I don't hear and I don't see, Helena, a lot of black churches getting involved with domestic violence awareness. And I don't, you know, the statistic that I read off earlier was over 37% of pastors don't believe that their own members are victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. So what does that say about the state of churches, where you've got you're supposed to go to church to, you know, to listen to the to the preacher, you know, give a good sermon, but also where are they at when it comes to providing resources or providing just that other outlet in the community when it comes to domestic violence? Because the numbers are there, because the numbers are high, but you've got so many people who just say, nah, that's not happening here.
This is my thoughts on those, and these are my thoughts. My thoughts are the church is ran predominantly by men, and for a woman to say, here's Johnny's hitting me, to pastor, and pastor would say, no, not Johnny. That's not the same Johnny I know that comes and he's on the deacon board and he's in the choir and he's here every time we have a meeting. When the church door is open, Johnny's right here. I don't believe Johnny's doing that, because mm-hmm. Johnny's his friend and Johnny wouldn't do that. And so the women of the church get quiet, because mm-hmm. why tell someone your secret when they're not going to listen? And then all of a sudden you are now the person that they're looking at. You're the problem, not the person that's beating you.
Yeah. And you know, and I think that's why so many women, again, are, you know, it's almost kind of like, who do I turn to? You know, you're mm-hmm. oftentimes family members are reluctant to get involved. Law enforcement, there's this trust between the law enforcement and the black community with the criminal justice system and social services. But I think another part of this conversation, Helena, is that there are not a lot of organizations like your organizations where it's people that look like you are helping people who are victims, who we look like each other. Do you see that as being plays some type of a role in people reaching out to get assistance? Because if they do go somewhere, those individuals who are working there don't look like them.
I absolutely agree. It's looking like them, and also being able to say, I've been there and I know exactly what you're feeling. And I know exactly how it feels to want to tell somebody what's going on and no one's listening. And I know what it's like to say, I need to leave, but I have no place to go. And again, mm-hmm. there's a big stigma about domestic violence, and especially about going to a shelter. Can you imagine a mother having to take her three children to a shelter? And so when the school bus picked the kids up, they're picking them up from a shelter. And so that now the kids are being bullied. So the mother's dealing with the stress of, this man's beating me. My kids are unhappy because of me being with this man. And here we are in this big circle with no one to help me and no place to go.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've seen movies that have portrayed black women that pretty much, you know, where the characters were probably being raised in the 1960s, where, you know, even the mothers told their daughters, just stay there. He's a good man. Mm-hmm. He's providing for you. Mm-hmm. He, you know, you got a home, you know. Mm-hmm. But they know and they see the wounds, they see the injuries, and they hear these daughters are talking to their moms about it. But it was just in that era that the mothers were telling their daughters to just stay with him because, oh, he, you know, he just going through. So I just, how does that, how do you wrap your mind around where you've got a family member or even a parent telling you to stay there because that's the best place you can be?
You can't wrap your mind around it when you're a victim, because you have no one and no place to go. But I want to say this as a domestic violence survivor, one thing that we always hear is you should leave, and the other thing we hear is you should stay. So imagine being beat every day and one person saying you should leave and the other person saying you should stay. Imagine the confusion. And here's another thing in domestic violence. If you are being abused, your partner has already isolated you from your family.
Yeah.
So that's an issue all within itself. You're isolated from your family. You don't go visit your family. You don't talk to your family. He is your family. He talks down to you. And so that everything is all mental. And what happens with survivors is a lot of times they don't go get help because in the Black community it's taboo to even go to a counselor. So we got to break all these taboos.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And I think that's why, you know, having this conversation like we are now about, you know, domestic violence and, you know, it's October, it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and the fact that this is a conversation that should be had, you know, every, you know, it's 365 days a year about domestic violence, because when you look at the statistics and it shows the high number of women of color who are victims of domestic violence. And I'll even say this, and I think even in the law, you know, being in the law enforcement community, some of these numbers are underreported. And so you have to believe that these numbers are even higher than what they are being reported, because oftentimes the police officers fail to report the information to them. They just want to go there because maybe they've been to this home multiple times. Maybe they've dealt with the wife and the husband. So they're just saying, hey, y'all work out your problems. I'm not your social worker, and we're out the door. But unfortunately, Helena, one of these times when you go to that home, somebody is going to be seriously injured, or there's going to be a death inside of that home. And it's all of those things could have been prevented.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, I agree. I'm that survivor. When they finally came to that home, someone was dead and I was in the hospital. So I agree.
Wow. And you know, and I think, you know, the stories that you are able to share as being a survivor, some women don't survive. And I think it's real important for Black men to play a role in having these conversations. And I think this is why when, you know, me and my co-host Chief Humphrey talked about what type of show we were going to have today, instantly, you know, we talked about domestic violence, because Chief Humphrey had reached out to you, and I think he came and spoke at an – or maybe you came and done something with him there in Little Rock. But it's real important that Black men be a part of this conversation, and not just where women are a part of this conversation.
Exactly. I think it's time that we stop normalizing abuse. It's becoming normalized.
Yes.
I saw my dad do it. You know, it's normal. That's what happens when I get mad at you, because that's what my dad did to my mom. It's normalizing. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to – I think that it's time for us to teach our Black men to protect us Black women.
Yeah.
I think it's time to normalize protecting us.
Yeah. And also, you know, people, a part of this conversation is when drugs and alcohol is used, people become impaired, people become, they're not the same person. And I think oftentimes people use that as to say, well, hey, he's a good person or she's a good person. They're just, you know, when they get to drinking alcohol or getting to use illegal drugs, they become somebody else. Well, you're making an excuse for it. And I think, you know, this is why our kids, our young girls and our young boys, when they experience domestic violence in a home, that can impact throughout their, you know, teenage years as well as when they become an adult.
Exactly. Again, it's normalized. It's what I saw all my life.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, Helena, we're coming up on the last few minutes of the show, and, you know, I've got to, because, again, I think we got so many people who are listening to the show who are probably not, you know, want to come on and actually talk about their experience or just talk about, you know, what they've seen related to domestic violence. But, you know, I would, you know, I think it's really important as we end this month to talk about the experiences of what the same-sex domestic violence that deals with the LGBTQ community. So, you know, we're going to reach – I'm going to reach back out to you so we can try to do another show next Tuesday to kind of recap on domestic violence because I think that's another important piece of this conversation is the LGBTQ community and have someone who is a survivor in that community come on and talk about what they experienced, how they dealt with law enforcement, because I know a lot of police officers, they just turn around and walk away when they see that it's two men fighting with each other, you know, or they see it's two women fighting with each other.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, hey, I want to remind everybody that if you miss any parts of this live show, that you can go to thebachelornews.airtime.pro, thebachelornews.airtime.pro, and listen to the rebroadcast of this show. But definitely tune in next Tuesday for another live episode of You and the Law broadcast show on the Bachelor News Radio Network. We're going to pick this conversation back up and continue the conversation about domestic violence awareness. But you've been listening to You and the Law on the Bachelor News Radio Network.